Tonight, we're appreciative to Ohel for partnering with us to make it happen. And really, I'm appreciative to all of you for coming out tonight, for showing that we, as a community, take this topic seriously, and that while it might not manifest itself on the outside, we realize that this is very real for so many of us in this room, and that we're going to begin on the journey to tackle this issue. And again, I want to thank Dr. Blumenthal for being here. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Norman Blumenthal.
Wow, what a wonderful introduction. Now you can only be disappointed. Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here. The rabbi of the community where I grew up used to begin his sermon with, "Before I speak, I want to say something." So before I speak, I want to say something too. First of all, I want to thank Rabbi Maskowitz and the community. Those of us in the Northeast, who probably think the world begins at the George Washington Bridge and ends at the Verrazano, even there we recognize what a remarkable community this is and what a remarkable shul this is. And to no small measure, the credit goes to your Rabbanim, to Rabbi Goldberg, to Rabbi Maskowitz. I can tell you that at YU, I run a program for the elite among the smicha. And we had a leadership program. We want to teach the young men aspects of leadership. And so once every 3 months, we invite a figure who has an important position of leadership in the Jewish community. I won't say that Rabbi Goldberg was number one, but he was number two, the second person, right after Howard Friedman, that we invited to teach our boys about building up a community, maintaining a community. Also, as long as I mentioned, I want to mention as well, many of you may know that Dr. Pelkovitz and I co-teach a very important and very unprecedented course, basically in pastoral psychology for the YU Smicha students. We have Moshe Winograd, who's not a psychologist, but who also attended this class. And the actual name of this class is the Lev Ladat, in memory of Ruth and Sam Aboff and Rose and Leo Goldberg, the grandparents of Rabbi Goldberg. And after we've been teaching this class for somewhere between 15 and 20 years, and I can tell you that now there are Rabbanim out there who are leaders of communities, and they still tell us that they reference the PowerPoints. They're still calling us, probably Dr. Pelkowitz more than me, but I'll get there someday. But they still referencing us, and the good that has been done as a result of that. I also want, as was mentioned earlier, acknowledge Ohel, that I have the privilege of working for and running their trauma team. I think Ohel is one of the best kept secrets in the Jewish community. I know when I started with them about seven or eight years ago, David Mendel, who's the CEO of Ohel, told me for the first 2 weeks I'm a tourist, and I'm going to tour all the facilities and programs that Ohel runs. And I visited some of the 73 homes they have for adults and adolescents with disability that are all kosher, near shuls, the shelters for women who are victims of domestic violence, again kosher, near shuls, shelter for teenagers, the clinics that provide services at sliding scale and low cost for the Orthodox community. And it's really remarkable, the scope of what they do, and it's under their auspices and their payments that I'm here today. So I want to acknowledge them and thank them. So we're going to talk about today, let me give you, if you want a preview, we're going to talk about the fairly dramatic rise of anxiety, particularly among children. I'm going to describe to you the changes that have taken place and how children are measurably more anxious today than they've been in the past. We're going to examine and explore why this is happening, but also, as I, was mentioned by Rabbi Maskowitz, I don't want to leave you here with just, worries. We're going to talk about some of the things that we can do, some of the approaches we can take today to address this issue of anxiety among our children. And by the way, I'm going to add, which I hadn't planned to originally, this is a fairly recent addition to this presentation, and unfortunately, a sign of the very recent times, is also spend some time addressing the issue of antisemitism, the upsurge of antisemitism, and how we explain this to our children, because that's one of the most common questions that I and members in the Ohel team have been getting over the last few weeks for very understandable reasons. So we'll try, again, we're just trying to figure this out ourselves, but how can we process and how can we explain antisemitism to our children? So just very quickly, what's anxiety? Okay, so there's fear and there's anxiety. Fear is being afraid of something that's happening pretty much at the moment. So if a lion is chasing you and you experience fear, you're a very normal person. And fear is an unpleasant experience, but necessary sometimes. You know, the blood rushes to the extremities, you're hyper-focused, you're trying to save your life. Anxiety isn't as immediate. Anxiety is usually a fear of something that's about to happen. So it's a fear of a test that you might be taking. It's a fear of a tax audit or something of that sort. You may be anxious about, which again is useful. Anxiety serves a very good, useful function. It mobilizes us. In fact, the research on test anxiety, for example, shows that the perfect mixture is a modicum of anxiety. Because if you're a child's about to take a test, if they're too anxious, they'll be paralyzed. If they're not anxious enough, then they're not motivated. So anxiety serves a function. The problem we deal with, let's say, anxiety disorders, as we call them, or people who are overly anxious, is when the anxiety is either disproportionate to the what may be happening or unwarranted. And therefore, a person's almost like an alarm system that goes off when there isn't a danger. And why that's happening and what we can do about it. So as I mentioned, we're seeing unprecedented levels of anxiety among children today. For example, research shows that the most common referral for adults for a mental health professional is anxiety. For children, it's the third most common referral following ADHD and conduct disorders. And those of you who don't know what ADHD is, it's probably what's afflicting most of you now. It's an inability to focus or concentrate or sit still. But it's a very common referral and growing. In fact, we have data going back to the 20s and 30s, particularly certain psychological tests that have been administered for that long. And we can trace the scores of children on these tests. And the evidence shows much higher rates and levels today of anxiety and even depression among children than had been in previous decades. And if you stop and think about it, it makes no sense. Yes, we have, okay, we recently had this upsurge in antisemitism. Yes, there are certain stressors, but if you think about it, we've never had a better life. There are no pogroms, there are no plagues, there are marauders encroaching on our community. We're living, you know, we live as Orthodox Jews pretty freely. We have our schools are sprawling and are beautiful schools. We're healthy, we're living longer and better, and yet our children are more anxious than ever before. Jean Twenge, who has done a lot of this work, a psychologist who's done, maybe psychiatrist, I don't remember now, done a lot of this work, writes, and I think it captures it. She says, even during trying times, such as the Great Depression, World War II, Cold War, and the turmoil of the 60s and 70s, children were happier and felt more secure. So that's the obvious question. Why? Why are today our children more anxious than even during those times that, if you look at it objectively, would seem to be more trying? And I'm going to tell you right now, as I talk about it, I'm going to sort of forewarn you, this is not a gloom and doom speech. I don't believe in hand-wringing. I don't believe in the good old days. I'm going to address what's changing in the world and causing this anxiety, but not with the spirit of, let's go back to the good old days. I am a very big believer in a philosophy that was very well expressed by one of the great theologians and philosophers of our time, known as Wayne Gretzky, who said, I skate to where the puck is going, not to where it's been. We have to skate to where the puck is going. We have to keep pace with how the world is changing and think forward and not think backwards. So I'm going to propose to you the following. You know, we all learned in history about the Industrial Revolution. And we learned about in the, 18th and 19th century, steam energy was invented, mechanization was invented. Suddenly the whole world changed. It wasn't just that we could mass produce, but people changed. People flocked to the cities. There was the urbanization of the world. People were no longer limited to farming and handcraft. Suddenly they could mass produce. We needed shipments, so railroads were invented and steamboats were invented. We had to communicate because people were importing and exporting. So the telegraph was invented. The whole world changed, but people's philosophy and outlooks. We had a whole new class of people who worked in factories. Their outlook had changed. Even the moths changed. If you remember learning how in England, how the darker moths suddenly survived more than the white ones because of the pollution from the industry. We are going through a revolution today. It's the technology revolution. And I'm not here, I'm not here to talk about technology. You had a wonderful presentation from Dr. Pelkovitz about technology, and he is the psychology gadol hador. I don't agree with him about everything he said, but it was a wonderful presentation, as only he can. But I'm not here to talk about technology, but what I want to try to demonstrate to you is that the advent of technology has not only changed in terms of that we have computers now, and we have social media, but technology has changed our relationships, our outlooks, as changing our children, and as changing how we parent our children. So it's a change. In fact, I think when the history books are going to be written, the technology revolution will rival, if not surpass, the Industrial Revolution in terms of how it has, in a global way, totally changed this world. Now, what do I mean? Let me give you just some examples, not even in parenting, although we'll get back into parenting, we'll get back to children and anxiety. Let's take, for example, medicine. And let's take specifically the patient-doctor relationship. Until fairly recently, if somebody was sick, or if somebody, especially if somebody had some sort of rare condition or rare disorder, they had to find a doctor, and whatever the doctor told them, they were at his or her mercy, whatever he dictated. That's out the window today. Because if somebody has a particular condition, even if it's not a rare condition, what's the first thing you do? You Google it. I often tell the story about the first time I Googled my name. So I Googled my name, and up came one of these medical evaluations, and it was horrible. It says, Dr. Blumenthal's selfish, he's only in it for the money, he doesn't care about his pay, and my heart's pounding. Which of my patients wrote this? I'm getting scared, more scared. At one point they say, and he just passes you off on his midwives. I don't have midwives. Okay, for the women of childbearing age, if any of you are ever in Australia, there's an OBGYN by the name of Dr. Norman Blumenthal. Don't go to him. He's terrible. But today, you Google the condition. And you walk into the doctor's office, and when he says, I want to do that, why aren't you doing what they're doing in Texas? Oh, you want that medication? Why not this medication? You walk in knowing not really as much as the physician, because the physician has the broader view, but in terms of facts and information, the patient comes in incredibly well informed. I was prescribed the medication prophylactically, and of course, what did I Google it? And my doctor told me to take it in the morning. And suddenly an article appeared and said, you better have taken it in the evening. So next time I saw him, I said, article says take it in the evening. So we had a machlekes, he said, the morning, I said, the evening, and so he won. But this is a whole patient-doctor relationship. Has changed, again, as a result of technology. Let's take education. Our Oval school-based team, together with the trauma team, are training schools now, training teachers. We're partnering with a number of schools right now in the New York area. Perhaps we'll expand. But we're training teachers to anxiety. We're training teachers to recognize, to diagnose anxiety, and what they can do to help the children cope with anxiety and how they can do to build up resilience and coping mechanisms. And as we do this training, invariably, there'll be a teacher, not a real pro, someone who's been teaching now for 20 years, been teaching history, been teaching math for 20 years, and they'll say, since when did I become a therapist? I'm here to teach history. I'm here to teach math. Why am I busy with anxiety? And you know what I tell them? I said, if all your job is only to impart information, we don't need you. Because these kids can click a mouse and find out anything they want. And if we're tailoring instruction, there are computer programs now, and schools are increasingly using them, that will exactly test the child's skills and will tailor the skills exactly to what the child needs. So I don't need you to teach and impart information. The role of the teacher is changing. I need you to teach the children how to responsibly use technology. I have to put the information in a meaningful context, but you're also more and more going to be dealing with the emotional adjustment of the children. We have deputized you as paraprofessional mental health professionals because we don't need you anymore just to impart information. Shiduchim, right? We're going to talk about mental illness, okay? What's going on with shiduchim? Today, before you go out with someone, you either get a resume, or if you're modern, you go on Facebook, and you find out all about the person. But we're finding out information about potential spouses and not in an interpersonal context. And not so long ago, you found out about the third cousin that's being locked up in the closet because he thinks he's Napoleon on a date. It was in an interpersonal context. Now you find it out in the depersonalized context. So you're ruling them out, or you're coming, I mean, I have guys coming into my office with their list, you know, and they're checking it off, you know, this and this and this. Sometimes I say to them, especially if they went on a date already, sometimes they haven't, you know, let put your list aside. Let me ask you, how many times did you laugh? How long was the date? 3 hours? Did it feel like 1 hour, or did it feel like 4 hours? Do you remember what her perfume smelled like? You know, to take it away from the lip, we're getting into this very depersonalized kind of way of picking spouses. And then one that I find fascinating, almost funny, which is we're losing the concept and the sense of privacy. Because everything gets posted on social media. I don't know how many of you heard there was in West Virginia, a guy broke into someone's home when the family was away, robbed the home, and on his way out decided to check his Facebook page. The police said it was the easiest crime they've ever had to solve. You know, everything is posted. Everything's out there. So you might say, so what's so terrible if we lose privacy? So let me explain something to you. How do we define how close we are to someone? How do we define interpersonal intimacy? By how much of ourselves we share with that person. So we share the most with our spouse, hopefully. Maybe less, but a lot with our family. And maybe even less, but a lot with our best friends. And then as friends get more casual, the less aspects, less personal information we share with them. But if everything is being shared with everybody, how do you know, or how do you define who's that special person and who's not such a special person? And guess what? We're losing a sense of romance. Couples today do not fall in love. They hook up. Today there's an app that will help you that if you want to have a baby and you don't want to get married or you don't feel like you can get married, you can find a suitable father, you shake hands, you have a child together, and you have visitation. He gets it 2 weeks, you get 2 weeks. In fact, and this is what part that sort of blows me away, there's some very recent data suggesting that couples are having less physical intimacy, but sexuality is becoming less and less important. The reason why this kind of cracks me and blows me away, because I spend most of my professional career trying to help particularly boys, I mean, I got more boys, adolescent boys and from the frum community exercise restraint and not get caught up in the sexual revolution so that they can have the necessary restraint until they're married. I think my successors, like the Moshe here, or those who are going to be treating kids in the future, are going to have the opposite problem. I'm going to try to convince them sexuality is important because we're becoming sort of desexualized. But again, all this is as a result of technology. So let's bring it back now to anxiety. How is technology contributing, or the technology revolution contributing to the presence of more anxiety? And what I'm going to propose here, number one, is dafka because life is so easy. And just because everything in life comes so easily because of technology, that our children are not developing coping skills. I mean, I'll give an example. I mean, it's not timely, but I'll give an example from, let's say, my children. I don't know how many New Yorkers are here who went, like I did, who went to MTA and YU. But I remember the years that I went to MTA in the 70s, we had to take that treacherous walk from the 184th Street subway station to the school. And some of the local denizens were not too fond of us and created some problems. In fact, I remember early in my career, one of my first jobs was I worked for a program, I worked in a clinic, we had a program with the court system that if there was a kid who committed a crime, and it was the first time they would say, instead of incarcerating him, let's send him for therapy. So I got these like thuggy kids that were referred to me. And I remember when I would meet their parents, they looked vaguely familiar. Like I said, didn't we once meet in the 184th Street and Audubon Avenue? You know, you were with like three of your cousins with baseball bats and chains, and I was all alone with a barely used Bubba Kama. You don't remember? I remember like... But the thing was, I learned skills. I learned how to manage that. I remember learning that if I spotted the gang before they spotted me, I'd change how I walked. But if they spotted me first, I had to make believe I wasn't scared because they could smell fear. Now, my kids went to school locally. went to school in the five towns. They didn't have to learn those skills. So do I, should I send them to a school in a ghetto somewhere so I can learn those skills? No, life has gotten easier and life has gotten more calm. But therefore, our kids are not learning the same coping skills. Let me show you some very interesting research you might have read about. The research on playgrounds. Again, many of us, again, my generation, or maybe even younger, but not the young, very young generation, can remember when playgrounds had cement on the floor and monkey bars were about 20 feet high. And if you fell, you paid a price. So now, we don't have monkey, we don't have playgrounds. Old playgrounds have this soft, cushy stuff on the bottom, and monkey bars are not allowed to be higher than 6 feet high. So we'd think that children would be safer. And actually, they're finding that children are getting injured more because they're not learning how to be careful. They don't have to be careful. So they're learning to be more reckless, and they're getting hurt even more. That's, in a way, what's happening. And therefore, because children don't have those coping skills, that therefore when something doesn't go quite right, if something isn't so perfectly accommodated as technology does for them, then they fall apart and they have a much harder time coping. And again, no hand-wringing. We're going to talk about what to do. One more thing that's extremely important in terms of understanding this, and this very much touches upon some of the trauma work that I do through OHEL. But we have what I often refer to as the over-informed child. What's happening is, when most of us were growing up, there was that period of childhood naivete, where we were protected. First of all, adults were the gatekeepers of what we found out. They decided what we know and what we don't know, and they would be the ones who would determine how this information is processed. That's out the window. Because today, a kid, again, can click a mouse and finds out everything. I have a childhood memory. I grew up on a very busy street in Queens. And I remember one Friday afternoon, it was a typical day in the Blumenthal household. My mother was making Shabbos. I was fighting with my sister. It was a normal day. And suddenly, there's screech of brakes and crash of metal. I remember my mother throwing off her apron. Now, those of you who know what aprons, I'll explain to you later. Running to the door. And I was about five, I think. I went running after her. And my mother very sternly turned around and said, "Now, you stay here. You stay inside." I remember how relieved I was. I wouldn't have to see what went on out there. If it was today, I would have gone anyway. Because children find out everything, and they feel, more importantly, they feel entitled to know. And we are constantly in a position, us and the trauma team, to have to share things with children that I don't want. It pains me to tell that to a child. A loved one who died of a suicide. I have to explain this to a five-year-old, to a six-year-old. Because they're going to find out anyway. And so there isn't that naivete of childhood. This was, by the way, the most common question that we got asked as mental health professionals following the Leiby Kletzky murder. I'm sure you'll remember the Hasidic boy who was murdered. In fact, I'll tell one other story. Just might try throwing a few. You have to imagine, in the middle of this horror, what was going on. I mean, first of all, the night before, I have to say it was a real Kiddush Hashem, I visited the family all over Brooklyn. People with flashlights screaming his name everywhere you looked. In fact, I got a call a day or two afterwards from the person who went to the backyard. I don't even know who he is. Then find someone went to the backyard of Levi Aaron, where he was, crying on the phone. So why didn't I scream his name louder? When, you know, it was very sad. In fact, the classics. Well, I'll get to it later. But so I already knew what was going on. And that morning, you know what, let me just stay away from that story. We're going to get a little too involved. But let me just talk about it in terms of the most common question. I'll get back to that story later. It actually fits later in the speech. I think I didn't take my Ritalin this morning. I'm sorry. But the most common question we got asked, after, it's interesting how each trauma has its own leitmotif. The most common question we got asked after the Leiby Kletzky murder was as following. "Dr. Blumenthal, I understand I have to tell my child that he was murdered. I have to understand, I have to tell my child that the perpetrator was from the Orthodox community. Must I tell him that he was dismembered? It's so grotesque. Why should my child know this?" So I created a mythical character. I call him the big stupid kid on the bus. Every bus, school bus, has one. I even tell parents, part of your tuition. You pay for a bus, a driver, and a big stupid kid. Because if you don't have one, the school imports one. All right? And I know them well. I raised two of them. This is the kid who tells everybody in the bus everything. So I said to the parents, if the child's going to find out, do you want him to find out from the big stupid kid on the bus, or from you. And children find out everything. So there isn't that naivete of childhood. And last but not least, and again, the rabbi mentioned this before, and I think it's important to mention, is the FOMO. It's the fact that everybody can get compared. Nothing is a secret. Any social event, any grade, any new dress bought, any new suit bought is publicized to everybody, and creating that sense or that dread that you're being left out, that you don't measure up. So what do we do? How do we handle this? And so first of all, I want to say something that might speak to a tension that I hear constantly between, let's say, my contemporaries and the younger parents who are raising their children. What I hear from my contemporaries is these parents are so concerned that everything has to be so perfect for their child. I have heard principals, I don't know if it happened down here yet, but I've had principals tell me that they get phone calls on Wednesday. Please make sure my son or my daughter has a play date on Shabbos. Since when was that my job? Again, I'm going to reflect myself. I always told my kids, I never heard this until my kids were, the whole concept of a play date. I told them when I was a kid, a play date was you went down to the playground, you played until the Italian kids came and beat you up. And then you limped home, that was the end of your play date, you know? You limped home, and the next day you either went back with your big brother, or if you didn't have one, you went back for more punishment. But this was a play date, you know? But now, it's suddenly the dread that your child will not have a play date. And parents, there's a feeling from the grandparent generation that the younger parents are spoiling the children and not giving them a chance to cope with life. But you know what? To some extent, the younger parents are right. Because again, technology revolution, the world that our children and grandchildren are growing into is going to be so tailored, is going to be so perfectly suited to them, that they don't need the same level of coping mechanisms that we did. And for that matter, we didn't need the same coping mechanisms that our parents did. Because life, the way Hashem made the world, in every generation, life gets easier. Life gets more mechanized. And things get easier. And particularly, again, as we're seeing such a rapid change. Let me portray for you what the life of our children and grandchildren are going to be like in 10, 20 years from now. Okay? So Yaakov's going to get up in the morning, and the computer sensor in his room, knowing exactly his pace in terms of getting ready, will have it perfectly timed, knowing exactly when the driverless car should pull up in front of his house to take him to shul. Now, of course, this driverless car has an accordion door like the airplanes do, so he doesn't need a code or anything like that, so he just walks right into this driverless car that takes him to shul. And, of course, the shul also has this accordion, so he can just walk right into shul. After davening, of course, there's another driverless car waiting to take him home. While he's in this driverless car, there is a computer sensor taking all his vital signs in terms of medical vital signs, etc., figuring exactly what kind of breakfast he needs to have to be perfectly healthy. And a console will come up with a choice of several healthy breakfasts that he can have, which he doesn't have to point or anything like that, but he just has to say it, because the computer already can deal with voice commands, and dictates what breakfast he wants. At which point then, the newfangled combination refrigerator, microwave oven, convection oven, and other things we can't even conceive of, is going to put together his breakfast timed perfectly, so the robot's going to put it right in front of him as soon as he walks through the door. At that point, a console will come down with all the news he needs to have, perfectly tailored to him exactly what his interests are. After breakfast, he's going to go to another room where his virtual reality Rebbe will come to teach him the Daf Yomi. This virtual reality Rebbe has in his database every Rishon, Achron, and every Shir ever given by a Rosh Yeshiva on any topic regarding to that daf, and knows exactly what he's interested in and can answer any single question. After the daf, his virtual reality personal trainer will come out and has it exactly again with the medical sensors and medical, will know exactly what kind of exercise he needs to do. Then he goes for his 2-3 hour workday, in which everything he earns is somewhere in cyberspace and the bills are paid immediately. He doesn't have to bother himself with it. And get the picture? That's the world they're going into. They don't need the same coping mechanisms. And the world will be a world that is more tailored to them. There still will be stressors, and there'll still be crises, but not to the same extent. And therefore, the younger parents in many respects, who are trying to make the world so absolutely perfect for their child, are really more in tune, perhaps, with the world that this child is going into than we are as the adults. But there still is room for work for what we should be doing. So number one, today, the school of hard knocks is gone. The philosophy used to be that we put the children, to some extent we instructed them, but to some extent we put our children in challenging situations and they learned how to cope. So certainly when I was a kid, if you came home and you said you were bullied, deal with it. That's part of life. Now we have bully prevention programs and we have instruction and you can call. Because we now give children coping mechanisms. Because again, it's a technology revolution. Everything is spelled out for them. Everything is catered to them. And therefore, we are training teachers now to teach children coping skills. And we're training teachers and parents to teach children resilience. We are training teachers and parents to teach children social skills. Certainly a generation ago, the only ones who needed instruction in social skills were those who, for whatever reason, for the issues of mental illness, had a problem in connecting and socializing. Today, everything, again, it's the age of the computer, it's the age of clicking a mouse, it's the age of everything coming to you easily. And therefore, as parents and as teachers, and to a certain extent as grandparents, we're teaching children skills that in the past they would have acquired just through life. Because that's not how our children think. That's not how the world is thinking. And that's one of those like global changes that is taking place in this new age of technology. We are informing children more about fact, and we'll get to that in a minute. I'm going to talk about antisemitism. We're not shielding children anymore. Children are told much more about what goes on in the world, but we help them process it. This is a big chunk of what we are doing on trauma teams, but we are training others, and we hope others will take over. So scary news, frightening news, realities, the fact that a child was murdered and dismembered, we're telling children, and we're helping them cope with it. We're putting that in a meaningful perspective, because, again, we can't shield them from it. And I'm going to propose to you that these children will grow up. Right now, they're very anxious from it. But as the world changes and they adapt to it, there'll be less anxiety. Because we will figure out how to explain it to them. They will learn how to process it. And therefore, will be less anxious. The only reason why we're seeing so much anxiety right now is because we haven't quite caught up. The reality is changing much quicker, and we haven't quite caught up how to process it. But that's what we're going to be doing, and that's the approach we're going to take. We're not insulating our children. We tell our children everything. Because if you think it's only people who have the internet, I will tell you, I was once speaking to a Rebbe in Vizhnitz, in a community of those, the kids have no internet, no TV, no English periodicals. And he told me that when he was a child, and they learned Kasibis, which in Aramaic is kasubis, which has some very explicit parts to it. The Rebbe would teach it. They had no idea what he was talking about, and that was okay. He says, now the kids know, and they're asking questions about it. Because they're even there. Everything is changing. And they're also more incredibly well-informed, and that's what we're going to be, that's what we do with our children today. Let me talk to you about one other fascinating type of research, and I think important for us to do with our children in order to help them learn how to cope with stress and anxiety. And that's the research on family narratives. There's a body of research showing that families who talk to their children about their own personal history and the history of their families, that these children have less anxiety and cope better than those whose families don't. And fascinating research shows there are three types of family narratives. And you'll tell me which one you think is the most effective. One is called the ascending narrative, which is the story begins with, it was terrible in the old country. We came here to this new country and it got better and better and better. The other one is the descending narrative. It was wonderful in the old country. It was great in the shtetl. We loved those pogroms. You know, it was really wonderful. It was great. It was so homey. It was so nice. Then we came to this country, and it's such a big country, and there was assimilation. Everything got terrible and terrible and terrible. And then there's the oscillating narrative. And the oscillating narrative is, it got better, then we came up some hard times, then it got better again, and then there were some hard times, and we coped. Which do you think is the most effective narrative to help children? The oscillating one. And it comes very important. I will share with you a person, that's why I was going to bring up the story of Vlad Bykletsky. Because I remember that I got that call, 5 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, I was shocked. And I got up, and, you know, first I didn't know what to do with myself. My wife, Norma, put your pants on. You know, like, she nursed me through it. And I came downstairs, and I was ready to leave. The deal was I was going to go to the family, and Moshe and Hasidic, in fact, it's actually kind of ironic that we had a Hasidic worker who went to the camp to speak, because the kids only spoke Yiddish. And Moshe called me in the morning. I was getting calls from everybody. What can I do? What can I do? And Moshe called me because we had worked together. And suddenly, I was in the middle of telling him, you know, the same thing I was telling him. I said, wait a minute. You once told me you're fluent in Yiddish. I said, yeah. He says, go to the Haida, right? So we had a YU Smicha student dealing with the kids in Yiddish. It was an interesting kind of paradox. But one of the great, I have to tell the forum story, no? Should I tell the forum? This is great. He's at the camp. This is right after the murder. And they're talking to the kids. There are about 8 kids. And in the middle of talking, suddenly, how many police officers showed up? About 5, 6 police officers show up. And they have to interview the children. It's a murder investigation. The Hasidic cheder. So Moshe and the other worker explained to the kids in Yiddish that the police have to talk to them, etc. But then each police officer would sit down with each kid. So he sit down with the first kid. So what's your name? He said, Moshe Yosef Rosenberg. So what's your date of birth? He goes, huh? He said, when were you born? He goes, ah, Purim. And the police officer says, huh? And the kid says again, Purim. So the one of them was going to walk over to the police officer, explain to him, which point the kid next to him was probably more worldly, gave him a zetz and says, there's the guy, he's a Purim. So in the middle of this catastrophe, we're laughing hysterically with the Purim, the Purim. But I got up that morning, and I suddenly said to myself, wait a minute, should I daven? I didn't know what to do. And then I suddenly had a flashback. My father, Oliver Shalom, was raised in Germany, came to this country when he was 18, was drafted to the army, and it's a little known piece of Jewish history, but how many people know about the Ritchie Boys? Anybody know about the Ritchie Boys?
Yes.
You do know about the Ritchie Boys, okay. The Ritchie Boys, they took about 200-300 German Jewish refugees, they took them to Camp Ritchie in Maryland, they trained them in interrogation and in espionage and translation, and they used their fluency in German to help the war effort. So my father also put on his tefillin every single day, 4.5 years in the American Army during the occupation. But I remember he told me that on D-Day and the Battle of the Bulge, he only had time to throw on his tefillin, quickly say Kriya Shema and run. So at that point, I threw in my tefillin, I said Kriya Shema, and I ran. But you see how the family narrative stays? And you see how it can be used. Very important part of helping our children cope is to tell them the stories about our own struggles, tell them the stories about our grandparents' struggles, and let them learn from them. And even if they look bored and they think, they're not, and they want to go and play, it's registering, and it's an important part of coping. One more point, or 2 more points maybe. Okay. Let me talk a little bit about anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism, the rise in anti-Semitism, I don't know if it's really hit you here yet in Boca. I know it's at Miami. But certainly in New York, there's a 165% increase in anti-Semitic assaults in the New York City subway system and a 53% increase in assaults, and specifically on overtly apparent Jews, on Hasidim and people wearing yarmulkes. And it's very painful. It's very difficult. I'm going to let you imagine for a second what it would feel like if somebody was mugged, if somebody was attacked because somebody wanted their money, versus somebody who was mugged and attacked just because they're Jewish. It's much more painful, and it's very scary, and our children are scared. And how do we help them cope with this? And for this, I want to share with you a very interesting experience we had, again, with the Ohel Trauma Team. Until about 3 years ago, when I would teach courses in trauma, I would talk about 2 types of trauma. One is that once-in-a-lifetime kind of horrible event but probably is not going to recur. For example, we got $1.5 million from FEMA to help people cope with Hurricane Sandy. And one of the things we had to help was children. Every time it rained after the hurricane, they would get petrified. Now, Hurricane Sandy in the Northeast was a confluence of three meteorological events. According to scientists, it can happen only once in 100 years. We could say to the kids, hey, this is a rainfall. This is not a hurricane. In fact, we hired the Philadelphia Science Museum, and they came into the school in a little glass case. They made a hurricane, they made a rainfall to show the difference to the children. Then, after Hurricane Harvey, we were asked to go to Houston to help them with the trauma of the flooding. There are two Orthodox communities in Houston. There's the old community that was higher up, but there's a community, Willow Terrace, actually they've relocated, that was horribly flooded. I mean, it was just a scene I'll never forget when we drove in there. Just even the stench and everyone's belongings in their front lawn, it was really horrible. But we couldn't take that same approach because Hurricane Harvey was their third flood in 16 months. So we couldn't say to the kids, hey, this is a once-in-a-lifetime event. On the other hand, it wasn't constant, because that's the other type of trauma, which is the trauma like child abuse or incarceration, which is every day. So which is it? We didn't know ourselves. So we called colleagues, we started looking through the literature, and we found a model for this new type of trauma, this type of intermittent, recurrent trauma. And you know what the model was? A city in Israel. Sderot, a beautiful town, they can live peacefully and everything. Every once in a while, Hamas wants to shake things up, and suddenly rockets are flying to the town. And of course, Israel being a Jewish state, they were deluged with mental health professionals studying them. And the approach there, whereas the approach for once in a blue moon type of trauma is, no, it won't happen again. The constant trauma is a whole other parsha. The approach here was, we can't promise you it won't happen again, but we're doing something about it. We're empowering ourselves, we're empowering you. We have a red siren. We have refuge, we have miklot. We're doing something to ensure your safety, and that's how we help them cope. And that's the same thing we're doing now with this upsurge in anti-Semitism. Yes, there is an upsurge in anti-Semitism. We hope it stops. But in the meantime, first of all, we live in a government that's protecting us. The police know too. In fact, when we went to Pittsburgh after the shooting, we were like a day or two after. By the way, this is why I don't get invited to parties, because people ask me what I do for a living, and as soon as I know, the party's over. But we went to Pittsburgh, and we were in the school a few days after the shooting. And a 7th grade Rebbe came to me and said, one of my students asked me the following question. Now, that was the first synagogue shooting. Now that it's been done, wouldn't every other violent anti-Semite now feel like he has a license to go in and do it? Isn't it what the Talmud calls an asek heter? And the Rebbe said, I think he's right. What am I going to tell him? And he's right. You know, when you have something that happens, now the taboo has been broken. And what I said to him, tell him he's right, but tell him the police know too. And they're going to be watching more carefully. And this is the approach we're taking now with this upsurge in anti-Semitism. Yes, there is an upsurge in anti-Semitism. Yes, we are being attacked more, but we're doing something about it. We have more security at shuls. The police know. There are more patrols in Jewish neighborhoods. They're trying to find out who these people are. We're traveling now. It's going to become now, some of the talk in New York is that Orthodox Jews, after traveling the subway, are going to meet in groups and travel as a group. So there's greater safety. We're taking necessary precautions. We also have to put it in perspective. Most people are kind. Most people are law-abiding. Not the whole world is out to get us. And there's one other perspective, and that sort of relates back to what I mentioned before about the family narrative, which has limitations, which is you can put it in the broader historical context. We can put it in the context of Yaakov and Esau. We can put it in the context of the Jews and Amalek, that this is an eternal struggle. This is not just a one-time event. We can do that with teenagers. You can't do that with preteens. They don't think that way. But with teenagers, we have that perspective. Let me conclude before, and we'll have some time for some questions and discussion, and I welcome it. One more way of coping, which is going to come very surprising to hear it from me. You really should be hearing it from Ari Moskowitz, but you'll hear it from me, and that's belief in Hashem, and that have emunah and belief that there is a greater good, that there's somebody omniscient and omnipotent who's calling the shots. And we know from psychological research that that belief that faith reduces anxiety. We have studies to show that. And I have to tell you, for me, that's such an anathema. Because when I went to graduate school, we were always being taught how religion breeds mental illness and all that. They tortured us. Now, I'd love to show some of those studies to my professors, but most of them are either dead or have Alzheimer's by now, so I can't get even. But it really showing it. And I'd like to conclude by quoting a paraphrase. I'm not going to quote it for time's sake. But a very beautiful piece that they say in the name of Yosef Ben Soloveitchik, and Rain the Rav, that appears in Ala Tshuva. And he says that a psychiatrist once came to him before the Yom Narayim and said to him he'd like to change the nusach of the davening. He'd like to get rid of Uvechein Tein Pachtecha, and you have given us fear. He said, so many people are beset by anxiety. Why should we daven to Hashem, give us fear, when fear and anxiety is causing so many problems? And the Rav said, I'm not a psychiatrist, but I think that's Dafka the point. There's one fear we should have, and if we have that fear, it dilutes and obviates all the other fears. If we have the Yiras Shemayim, if we have the belief in Hashem, let's just quickly quote him what he said. This one fear should come. And should free us up from all the other fears. Who come to our doors and disrupts our lives. So let's not lose we have it. Let's use it. And hopefully, God willing, help our children cope with the anxieties and the realities of the world today. Let me conclude with that. Let me see if any rebuttals, questions, anybody wants to... Yeah, take it in. Now we can play. Go ahead. Yeah.